You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In this podcast, we are bringing you another highlight from One Crown Office Row's recent seminar, Erasure, Remediation and Rights of Appeal in Disciplinary Proceedings. In this episode, we hear from One Crown Office Row's Owain Thomas QC with a talk entitled Upholding Public Confidence Argument. Is it undermining remediation?
The topic of this talk is the maintenance of public confidence and what the sort of decision-making routes are when a panel or committee or tribunal is making a determination of what the public interest requires. And determining what is required to uphold public trust is not at all easy to identify, and it's even harder to identify why the public interest requires, say, erasure in a particular case, and is not instead met by a lesser finding or perhaps even no finding of impairment at all. And the reason we suggest in the paper is that at the heart of decision-making based on public confidence is a fundamental difficulty, and that is that while on the face of it, it is a determination of what the public interest in a given case requires, the actual decision very often has little to do with the particular circumstances of the case and is instead a means of making a finding of impairment or imposing a particular sanction, despite the fact that the professional in question has sought to and has put right some or indeed all of the problems identified by the regulator. It is therefore an inherently open question. It's an inherently subjective question. It allows a tribunal to find that while significant remediation has been done, while someone poses no threat to public safety, while there's no risk to patient harm, there's no likelihood of repetition, still, maintaining public confidence requires X or Y to be found. There doesn't seem to be any particular form of reasoning process or set of standards against which to benchmark a determination of that kind. And the open-ended nature of the judgment call, perhaps a kind way of describing it, is important not only because it is relatively independent of an identified impairment, but also because its nature as a judgment call makes it very difficult to challenge on an appeal. And we've already heard that questions of evaluation of this type are described as jury questions. The approach of the appeal court is likely to be diffident in the extreme in terms of its preparedness to accept a challenge to that overall judgment when the judgment has been made by the designated specialist tribunal told by Parliament to make these decisions. And indeed, calling it even a jury question is a bit of a stretch, because juries aren't normally asked to determine what the public interest requires. They're normally asked to say, has he done it or has he not done it? And jury questions are normally involved with the analysis of evidence. So while some questions, is this dishonest by the standards of ordinary people, is this sufficiently serious to warrant erasure, those are questions of value judgment. But what does the public interest require in this case is a completely different kind of value judgment, I think. So where does all this come in? If the GMC's job and the job of other regulators is to protect the public, where does public confidence come in? Well, it comes in at the very high level. In the handout we've set out, the overarching objective of the GMC is to protect the public. Now, on the face of it, that would not obviously engage a responsibility for maintaining confidence in the profession by reference to what the public might think. But 1BB included in that overarching objective is to promote and maintain public confidence. And we see in similar terms Healthcare and Social Care Act for other healthcare professionals, social workers, and so on. In the sanctions guidance, several instances we set out there where public confidence is recommended as a basis for decision making despite a lack of an identified impairment in the professional's ability to conduct the profession in question. legal profession subject to similar kinds of considerations, not so much in the core standards, but in, for example, the Solicitor's Disciplinary Tribunal guidance. The function of the tribunal is to protect the public from harm and to maintain public confidence in the reputation of the profession. BSB similarly. So what evidence is there about public confidence? Well, in response to Bauer-Garber, the BMA made a comment which said, we've previously expressed concern that the public confidence criterion could lead to trial by media, and called for guidance that properly relates public confidence to the GMC's overarching objective. One particular problem is the subjectivity of public confidence considerations, which can lead to the same act being treated differently in different cases depending on the extent to which the patient is harmed. We would like to see research into the question of what members of the public would really expect in cases involving clinical error. Well, there's one interesting publication by the Professional Standards Authority which we've referred to, and I'd like just like to read a bit of it out, because it was looking at this question of dishonesty, which is a big issue in the recent case law. There's been a slew of cases of solicitors appealed by the SRA to the High Court on the grounds that suspensions were ordered instead of striking off in cases which didn't meet the strict exceptional circumstances rule that applies to solicitors. And similarly, a large number of dishonesty appeals in cases of medical professionals. So this was a piece of research commissioned by the PSA from an outfit called Policis, and they did 8 focus groups with the public held in each of the 4 nations of the UK from all social groups, including heavy users of healthcare and non-heavy, a range of ages and life stages. They did interviews with people in nursing homes and people dependent on care, and then they did 4 groups with professionals, some health, some non-health, again a wide range of professionals involved in a wide range of professions. And they put 9 scenarios to them of actual FTP cases involving dishonesty of various different kinds. A gradation, you might say, of dishonesty cases involving patients, not involving patients, financial gain, non-financial gain, a range. What was the outcome? Well, there was a minority who saw issues in black and white and who judged any incidence of dishonesty as grounds for immediate expulsion from the profession. The great majority of both public and professionals took a more nuanced view, with judgments more finely balanced around aggravating and mitigating factors. Premeditated, systematic, long-standing abuse of professional trust normally led to people viewing that as a case for rapid deregistration. The majority, however, with the exception of the most egregious cases, took a pragmatic and tolerant view on the appropriate disposals for dishonesty in FTP cases. The tendency was towards an emphasis on behaviour change and learning and rehabilitative and constructive outcomes, which allowed registrants to continue in the profession. This was particularly the case when the individual showed insight and remorse and seemed willing and capable of changing their behaviour. Now, that sort of finding runs flatly contrary to the approach that the courts take, completely contrary to it. Remediation is all very well in clinical error cases because you can show you can do the technique now, you can show you're much better at communicating with patients now. But if you've been dishonest, that is a finding which strikes at the core of the profession, the public would expect us to do this, etc., etc., etc. Well, it seems the public doesn't actually expect you to do this if this piece of research is to be accredited. Another thing they do is they do what they call a ladder or a stairway of significance of factors which the public thought were particularly significant. The top was predatory conduct, so dishonesty in the course of a campaign of exploiting somebody vulnerable. What factor do you think is at the bottom of that stairway? The bottom factor is this: direct threat to confidence in the profession. The least significant feature, according to the public. And they say this: the public, and to a lesser extent the professionals, who are more protective of the reputation of professions, were also pragmatic in assessing the validity of any threat to public confidence. In thinking through appropriate disposals, the majority sought to balance any potential threat to public trust and the public interest with the rights of the registrant, registrant's investment in their careers, and their ability to earn. Generally, both public and professionals appear to take a more sceptical view than the regulators of threats to public confidence, unless impacts were clear and direct. considerable pause for thought then when it comes to looking at the case law, because the case law is, I think, replete with examples like the case at paragraph 26, case of GMC in Patel. So in Patel, this was a doctor who had been booked to do NHS sessions and private sessions and had been found to be dishonest in double claiming as between the two. And the panel, because of the effect that a suspension would have had on his ability to carry on training, he would have, they say, lost his training number and it would have had a particularly significant impact on him, decided to conclude the matter with no sanction for a dishonesty case. They explicitly addressed the question of the public interest and they said, well, we think the public interest in this case is vindicated by the finding of impairment. We found him to have been dishonest. We find that he's impaired as a result of that. But when it came to stage two evidence, we found him to be an utterly open and credible witness, absolutely determined to put all this behind him, and we think the public would not regard a more interventionist sanction as being merited. That was overturned on appeal, in large part courtesy of the paragraph which I've quoted in the handout. In my judgment, the decision made by the panel was not sufficient for the protection of the public because it failed properly to maintain public confidence in the medical profession and to maintain proper professional standards. It was not sufficient to protect the public in light of the MPT's own findings about the earlier dishonesty. In my judgment, the mere fact of the regulatory process having been undertaken does not send a sufficient signal either to the public or to the members of the profession. Why not? Is the obvious question. Why not? I mean, the original panel went through all this and decided in their judgment, for reasons that they identified, that it was sufficient. And you read that judgment in Patel and many of these other cases, and there's a sort of oracular pronouncement that this is or isn't sufficient to maintain public confidence, but with absolutely no analysis of why not or why so. And that provides a real challenge when presenting these cases, because there is no way around addressing the question head on in a case where you've got a clinical error with a disastrous outcome, where you're going to get over the identified skill problem by remediation evidence, but where you're faced with the fact that someone died, say. Or in a sexual misconduct case where you've got a conviction and a long passage of time, say, since the conviction before the hearing, where you can demonstrate insight and so on, but you're left with the fact that there's a very serious sexual conviction and you're going to have to address that head on. So there's no real substitute for just addressing the panel on it directly and saying, well, if you are going to find that the public interest requires X, Y, or Z, then what are your reasons for doing so? And engage in that argument and plant the uncertainty and subjectivity of this concept in their minds. I mean, I've had two wildly contrasting examples of this. One, a consultant who was in charge of a research project and as a result of a massive overdose of cancer drugs, a young man in his 20s died in circumstances where he would not otherwise have died. He would probably have been cured of his cancer. And in that case, the parents of the young man were in the tribunal every day, visibly moved every day of the hearing. And we emerged with a finding of no impairment in the face of a submission by the GMC that the disastrous organisation of this research trial required, the public interest required such a finding. But for various reasons, lots of remediation, he was otherwise an exemplary physician of senior standing, fantastic testimonials, all the rest of it. The panel said we would be not doing a discerning job if we just leapt on public confidence as a means of justifying a finding in this case when it is so obvious that he's not impaired. And then a vet, before he became qualified, had two convictions for sexual misconduct, punished by a community order by the criminal courts, unblemished in terms of his ability to be a vet, was a good student, had done his training well, had offers of jobs, testimonials from women who'd worked with him saying, I have absolutely no problem at all, I'll give him a job tomorrow, struck off. Now, as Bill says, he has an opportunity to apply for reinstatement in 10 months, and that may be an unconscious, if illicit, driver of that decision. But again, a decision founded solely on the grounds that the public, looking at this, knowing that the criminal courts had punished him for the sexual misconduct, knowing that the sexual misconduct is out with the scope of his normal job as a vet, would think it remiss if we were not to have both found him impaired and struck him off. No particular reasoning proffered for it, but again, quite difficult to challenge on appeal. So a win and a loss, but you can see that it is a radically uncertain and subjective concept, and quite a difficult and unsafe basis, I would suggest, for many of these decisions.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.